The Marine Corps innovates and modernizes its force, but encounters pushback from outside and within its own ranks. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker. Today's episode is going to be discussing how the United States Marine Corps is adapting its forces to pivoting away from counterterrorism fight that we've been engaged in for the last 20 years and now moving towards that near peer competition, specifically focusing on China. So today I'm going to take you through three items that the Marine Corps is encountering at the moment. One, it begins with their transformation of their forces. Secondly, it's the pushback that the command level units are experiencing of that during this transformation. And lastly, we're going to discuss how the Marine Corps is, as they go through this innovative process, as they start implementing cyber warfare and cyber units as a part of their overall fighting capability. I did want to highlight an addition from episode 60, where I talked about nuclear war. I just was going back over that episode, and I wanted to kind of add on in addition to clarify some comments specifically about which countries are able to launch a nuclear missile from within their own borders and target almost anywhere within the world. Today, there are at least five countries that possess missiles that can fly a range of 13,000 kilometers, which can hit targets almost anywhere on Earth. That includes, obviously, the United States, but additionally, Russia, China, India, and North Korea. During that episode, I mentioned that the United States had this capability, but there were many other countries with the ability to launch, say, from a submarine or a high-flying bomber. While that is true, I wanted to clarify and add that the missiles with the capability of flying 13,000 kilometers currently that I'm aware of are by these five countries that are listed. Just wanted to highlight that clarity from that earlier episode, episode 60. If you go back and you're listening or you listen to it the first time, you're wondering what that was about. If you noticed that comment, just wanted to add a little more context and clarity. But let me get back into tonight's episode on the Marine Corps and its innovation. Let me take just a really quick ad break, and then we will get to work. All right, welcome back, everyone. So I just want to get started with the transformation the Marine Corps is currently undergoing. Now, this is being led from its commandant, General David Berger. Now, what every branch in the military has is basically its highest ranking officer. He or she dictates where the force is going, you know, in the short to near term of 3, 5, or even 10 years. In the instance of General Berger, he became the commandant of the Marine Corps on July 11th of 2019. And what he immediately published is his commandant's planning guidance, which lays out his vision for where the Marine Corps needed to go. And this is what every commandant does. However, General Berger's vision was different, and it implied some major changes in many areas. Now, this is an article from Mark Canson. He's a security advisor from the Center for Strategic and Intelligence Studies. And he highlights that this vision that General Berger lays aligned with the National Defense Strategy and focused exclusively on China. Now, this isn't surprising. General Berger had commanded Marine forces in the Western Pacific. The vision sought to kind of meld the Marine Corps traditional, you know, quote, force and readiness, that's always been its bread and butter, that role with that of readiness for great power conflict. And within the piece that the commandant's planning guidance, he writes that the Marine Corps will be trained and equipped as a naval expeditionary force in readiness and prepared to operate inside actively contested maritime spaces in support of fleet operations. And I'll be able to kind of pull apart these different pieces of what the Marine Corps has traditionally done and General Berger's vision of where it should be, especially as China is the rising threat in the East and Southeast Asia regions. So central to Berger's vision is the ability to operate within an adversary, this being China's, bubble of air, missile, and naval power. All right. Now, what the Marine Corps, what the Marine Corps calls, if you will, this kind of bubble of this power is the Weapons Engagement Zone, or WES for short. It's not an acronym. I can't be in the military. So the concept is that the Marine Corps will be a stand-in force that will operate within the WES, not a standoff force that must start outside and fight its way in. So as the guidance states, stand-in forces are optimized to operate in close and confined seas in defiance of adversary long-range precision standoff capabilities. This requires developing low signature, affordable, and risk-worthy platforms, because existing ships and aircraft are the opposite. They're highly capable, but they're really expensive. There are not many of them, and they're highly visible. So let me give you kind of in very layman's terms what this vision is. You've heard me talk about the future conflict that's inevitably going to happen in the South China Sea, and I say inevitably in my view. As China continues to build its military presence in the South China Sea, General Berger's vision here is rather than the Marine Corps in an instance of going to combat and going to war with China, the Marine Corps having to fight its way into the number of island chains that China is building up, rather than that, the Marine Corps will be positioned inside this WES, this Weapons Engagement Zone, on a more autonomous style of operations, launching from different military bases or patrol bases, that it can launch its more maneuverable, more capable vessels to immediately begin the fighting within this kind of this bubble, so to speak, of it, China's military power. So that's what he wants. He essentially wants the Marine Corps to go from its bigger, larger amphibious capabilities to much more maneuverable, lean, able to kind of fighting force inside these, you know, coastal regions to be able to engage China within its own, sphere of influence, if you will. That's what essentially he's trying to create. Now, another element of this new concept is what they call distributed operations, which is the ability of relatively small groups to operate independently rather than a part of a large force, which is as in previous wars. Quote, we recognize that we must distribute our forces ashore given the growth of adversary precision strike capabilities and create the virtues of mass without the vulnerabilities of concentration. Thus, small marine forces would deploy around the islands of the first island chain and the South China Sea, each element having the ability to contest the surrounding air and naval space using anti-air and anti-ship missiles. Collectively, these forces would attract Chinese forces, inhibit them from moving outward, and ultimately, as a part of a joint campaign, squeeze them back to the Chinese homeland. So this is what the general is trying to achieve by making these, creating more nimble marine crafts and vessels and units to go operate within these contested areas. In his view, this would push back Chinese forces, not allowing them, prohibiting them from continuing to pushing out the Chinese bubble of military power further and further into the South China Sea. General Berger is advocating that we begin operating within these contested areas and now with a more lean force. Now, a third element of his vision is an institutional change. That means the Marine Corps would leave sustained ground combat to the Army, and it would focus on the littorals or coastal regions. Now, ground wars in the Middle East, North Korea, Europe would be the Army's responsibility. Now, the final element was of his vision is political. General Berger's judged that defense budgets are likely just to be flat for the foreseeable future. Quote, he says, my assumption is flat or declining budgets, you know, not rising. If an increase happens, great, but it's this whole vision is built based on flat or declining budgets. So what does that mean for the Marine Corps? Unlike in the previous 5 years when rising budgets allowed new investment and stable force levels, trade-offs would now be necessary. If the Marine Corps wanted to invest in new capabilities, the capabilities that Berger is outlining in his vision, it's going to have to cut some existing units. Implementation for this transformation, it's going to be a 10-year effort that makes radical changes that the guidance implied. The restructured Marine Corps will focus single-mindedly on a conflict with China in the Western Pacific. It's going to build capabilities for long-range and precision engagement in a maritime campaign, eliminate capabilities for counterinsurgency and ground combat against other armies, and get smaller to pay for the new equipment. So this transformation is pretty radical in the sense that the Marine Corps is in a way abandoning some more of its traditional roles and pivoting its entire focus on China. Here's the challenge. America's a global empire. It's a global power all around the world. We have, I think the last I saw was like 700 military bases, okay? And I mean, these are globally. How does any one of our military branches operate in the different regions around the world when different regions and different adversaries have different capabilities, right? The Iranian military is not the Chinese military. Different capabilities, different terrain, different fighting styles. So how could like the U.S. Marine Corps, for example, be capable of fighting China with its own preparation, by its own, I'm referring to the Marine Corps, by its preparations, by its weapons, by its tactics and techniques and procedures? How could it be the same force that would go be able to fight Iran in the Middle East in a desert combat? How would you do that? You would have to be able to train on a whole host of battlefield competencies. Now, in the General Berger's mindset, the future conflict is going to be solely with China. And he appears to be disregarding regional conflicts that will pop up by only focusing on this near-peer competition with China. That is essentially the virtue of what he's trying to do. Now, he has stated in his guidance, quote, this single purpose-built future force will be applied against other challenges around the globe. However, we will not seek to hedge or balance our investments to account for these contingencies. What he's saying is, despite the fact that the Marine Corps will engage against other conflicts around the world if need be, they'll go do so. But what they're not going to do is change their preparation for China in order to be prepared for those other challenges. It's not going to change its investment, its focus on China just to go fight another conflict in another part of the world should it pop up. So this is the vision of the current commandant of the Marine Corps. He has taken the Marine Corps to, frankly, another direction that it's focused on before and has in the past, but now it's really restructuring its capabilities, and we'll get into how those capabilities have changed and intend to change in the next 10 years as we discuss kind of the pushback that this General Berger's vision has received. So again, coming to the article, Kansian highlights that history is littered with examples of militaries that prepared for one kind of conflict and then had to go fight a very different kind of conflict. In the best circumstances, militaries adapt at the cost of time and blood. In the worst circumstances, the result is catastrophic failure. If I can even make a side note to the example we're seeing right now in Russia and Ukraine, Russian military is not designed to defeat the Ukrainian military, and it has failed to even fulfill basic wartime tasks, but it's more importantly failed to adapt to that dynamic battlefield. So this is the case that Kansian's highlight. This is certainly the case that it can result in catastrophic failure if a military can't adapt to the different kinds of conflict that happen. Now, again, Kansian writes that unacknowledged in this new Marine Corps approach, as it is across in the entire department of the Marine Corps, is the tension between preparing for a conflict against a great power adversary and the need to maintain day-to-day commitments for ongoing conflicts, allied and partner engagement, and crisis response. Its smaller size, the smaller size of the Marine Corps, will put stress on the remaining forces if deployments continue at the current level. He's highlighting that if the Marine Corps is going to solely focus on China like it's discussing, the challenge is, what about all the current engagements that the Marine Corps is a part of around the world? It's going to stress those forces if those deployments continue as where they are, unless Marine deployments completely shift away from that and only focus on China. The stress will be very damaging to the Marine Corps. Lastly, the Kantians highlighting the final risk for this vision is whether the new war fighting concept of distributed operations within the adversary's weapons engagement zone will work. The Marine Corps has sensibly conducted a lot of wargaming and satisfied itself that the concept's going to succeed. However, as Marines have noted, the enemy does get a vote, right? Maintaining small and vulnerable units deep inside an adversary's weapon engagement zone will be challenging. Even small units need continuous resupply with fuel and munitions. And if that's not possible, or if the Chinese figure out a way to hunt these units down, this concept collapses. And additionally, some of the pushback that the Marine Corps has received, or I should say General Berger has received with this new vision, it's how to actually execute it. Like the weapons that are going to be swapped out for this new, more nimble fighting force. An article from Dr. Daniel Gore. He's a senior vice president with the Lexington Institute. It's a think tank in D.C. Either the Marines would be a force designed to operate in a high-end conflict, which is one reliant on light amphibious warships, or the Corps would maintain its role as a multifunctional force. You know, the proverbial Swiss Army knife, relying on large amphibs, but in smaller numbers. And that's currently what the Marine Corps has done. It's relied on these large amphibious vessels, just fewer of them, versus the vision that Berger is laying out is a lot more smaller, more nimble vessels. And in the Navy's fiscal year 2023 budget submission, it proposes just truncating the planned procurements of this vessel. It's called the LPD-17, and retiring older ships, which virtually guarantees that the residual amphibious fleet is just going to be too small, too old to adequately support operations across the entire continuum of conflict, meaning that of all the things that pop up on the Navy's radar that they had to go resolve with the complementary force of the Marine Corps, by shrinking it down to just focusing on this residual fleet, it's just going to be too small. Now, the proposed Navy budget could also seriously damage the nation's shipbuilding industrial base. I wanted to make a comment on this. For example, say Berger's vision is brilliant. It's the greatest thing ever in warfare. It's not just his vision and it gets to go become executed. He has to go pitch, you know, first of all, submit this budget that has to go to Congress. And Congress is accountable to us, the people. And we have a say in a way. We have a say in how our government spends money on military defense. Think about this. A congressman, say, who lives, is responsible for, say, you know, the Virginia coast, where there's a lot of naval bases that build these ships, versus a congressman, I don't know, in the middle of Oklahoma. One is going to have more of an incentive to push such a budget and keep those jobs in his nation's shipbuilding industrial base versus the other, say, Oklahoma congressman who's maybe not feel the same way. The point I'm making is, though these things could be the greatest idea for a concept in the military, it doesn't mean it's always going to be passed. There are multiple, you know, levers at play, so to speak. But continuing on, General Berger has made a detailed case for the acquisition of a new class of small amphibious ships, which is dubbed the Light Amphibious Warship, or LAW for short. What it is, it's designed specifically to support smaller, lighter Marine Corps units operating as a stand-in force. The LAW is going to be relatively small, light, and cheap, right? So this is how he's going to actually execute this whole vision, by acquiring the LAW warship in order to provide these smaller Marine units inside the WES, the weapons engagement zone, to push back against Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. Now, the Commandant argued that in the era of advanced ISR, that's intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, you've seen drones like on TV shows and movies, that's what they do, and long-range precision weapons, it was no longer possible to conduct amphibious maneuvers by massing large amphibious warships close to shore and within the range of an adversary's weapons. Concerns regarding the survivability of a small light vessel, you know, have been raised. Efforts to make the law more survivable are likely to result in skyrocketing cost increases. This could make the program unaffordable. This is why, as stated, many in the defense establishment, which seemingly includes some in the Navy, have adopted kind of an either-or position on amphibious vessels. The Marine Corps can either have small amphibs or large. They can't have both. However, it's the absolutist notion that large ships are vulnerable while small ships are not, that's fundamentally flawed, according to Dr. Gurr. It depends on the scenario, the capabilities of the adversary, defensive operations, and tactics. And this is kind of the challenge that at least I'm seeing from Berger's vision. Focusing solely on China, you and changing the entire force, preparing for this one enemy, by doing so, you're limiting the entire Marine Corps' capabilities to inevitably fight in another scenario against an enemy with different capabilities, different tactics, defense operations, etc. I think the point Dr. Gore is making is very spot on here, because the whole vision of General Berger is, in fact, that these large ships are vulnerable and small ships are not, and that's not entirely true. Now, again, Dr. Gore continues, if the decision to truncate those LPD-17s, if that happens, this is going to do serious, possibly irreparable harm to both the amphibious warfare fleet and supporting industrial base. It will seriously impact the shipbuilding supply chain, raising costs for all the other surface warfare programs, and moreover, reconstituting the fleet and restarting production of LPD-17s, should that be necessary, like in the future, it's going to be extremely time-consuming and costly. So what you're hearing right now is a lot of comments about costs, supply chains, budgets, all that goes into fighting warfare, fighting war. As a military planner, you have to consider, frankly, how many dollars you have to spend on being the most effective, capable force. In General Berger's view, the main fight for the future is China. He might very well be right. You know, we've talked about this a lot in this podcast, the threat to China poses. He is considering that the Marine Corps needs to completely restructure itself to fight the Chinese adversary, and he still has to do so within the confines of a budget proposal. Right. Again, finishing with Dr. Gore's article, interpreting Commandant Berger's arguments narrowly and rigidly, it might result in the Marine Corps being saddled with an aging and obsolescing fleet of large amphibs and a law, that small warship, that is too expensive to procure in quantity. As a consequence, the U.S. military could lose a unique and vital capability to conduct operations from the sea across the spectrum of conflict. And this is to kind of wrap up this pushback that General Berger's vision is receiving. If you look at just how the Marine Corps so far has been able to make adjustments in its forces to pay for everything, and I mentioned that earlier at the beginning, of this would be kind of an expensive notion. The Marine Corps actually asked for a little bit more money in its most recent budget proposal, but it's making cuts to certain units in order to fund this procurement of these light amphibious warfare. The light amphibious warships. So, an article from the National Review actually wrote about this. To foot this new bill of General Berger's vision, the Marine Corps has already eliminated all its tanks and plans to cut its cannon artillery batteries by 76%. Reduce the number of Marines serving in the infantry battalions by 41%, and decrease its aviation by roughly a third. If you're listening to those numbers and you think that's substantial, you are spot on. First of all, its entire Marine Corps tank capability is now gone. They no longer have tanks. Additionally, cannon artillery is going to be reduced by 3/4 of a whole 76%. Even if the infantry battalions, this is like Marine Corps bread and butter, what they do, it's going to reduce those battalions by 41%. And the Marine Corps aviation, it's in case you didn't know, Marine Corps have pilots just like the Air Force and Navy and the Army. Helicopter pilots, fighter jets, etc. They're just going to cut those aviators by a third. The Corps wants to shrink its active duty forces to just 174,000 Marines by 2030. This is the same number of Marines in the aftermath, the media aftermath of 9/11. And this is when the Corps started to grow in the media aftermath of 9/11. These are substantial cuts. Now, the Marine Corps has always been the smallest, traditionally the smallest branch now until the Space Force was created. And I'll do an episode on them and their numbers. But the point is, the Marine Corps has always been the smallest. So it is buying an wholesale into this vision that China is the main focus of the future in America's adversary. Again, with their article, one such tactic that we want to talk about the Marine Corps is traditionally fulfilled. It's what we call combined arms. And what we're seeing with this, what we've seen in the other military branches as well, it's over the last, 60, 70 years, you've had those in the defense establishment who believe that advanced technology, new technology, was going to determine how every future battle is fought that the United States will encounter. So there's this like push and pull between those who wanted to expand budgets for the military to buy the NATO, the next high-speed fighter jet or now artificial intelligence and so forth. You know, these are kind of what they call the technophiles. And then the Marine Corps, on the other hand, they were always over here seeing warfare very much how it is, just visceral, bloody, violent, very human, face-to-face, and they have been correct. And they've always been able to fill that role whenever it was needed. So when we combine this traditional role of being a tactic of combined arms, which is the employment of two or more arms together in complementary ways, that would be saying allowing each arm to exploit the strengths and protect the weaknesses of the others, which is why it's combined. Typically, the three main components of combined arms are infantry, tanks, artillery, to which the Marine Corps adds aviation and other capabilities. Well, what was I just talking about before? What did the Marine Corps cut? Tanks, infantry, artillery, aviation. So by eliminating tanks and gutting the infantry, artillery, and aviation, this, what they're calling the Force Design 2030, severely degrades the Marine Corps' ability to conduct combined arms warfare. General Berger's vision is kind of buying into this very much the technophile way of conducting warfare, specifically with the focus on China. And I think it's safe to say that the pushback that this vision is receiving, I think it's well-placed. And I think it makes plenty of sense that by focus, you're kind of putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, I'm in the same opinion that, yes, China is our main adversary, not just militarily, but economically as well. That being said, a 9/11 has happened. It could very well happen again. Throw out a hypothetical. I've covered so many possible military conflicts the United States can encounter on previous episodes. And the Marine Force has always been kind of ready deployed at a moment's notice. That's like their one of their best capabilities, is they've always been able to fill a gap quickly to a developing conflict scenario. But as Berger's vision's kind of pushing into this kind of narrow and kind of silo of just focusing on China, though he does claim it's not going to take away from their willingness to deal with other challenges around the world, it could get them in a pinch. For example, the army was for decades focusing on fighting the Soviet Union, and then Vietnam kicked off. They were really prepared for conventional warfare, and then they got into a counterinsurgency, and we got our butt handed to us in a lot of ways. We adapted certainly throughout that process, but this is the challenge for any military, especially one that's global like the United States, is how do you prepare for all these scenarios? For example, China only has to focus on, like I've talked about this before, only wants to focus on, invading Taiwan. That's what their prep is all about. Obviously, fighting a conventional maritime conflict. But they're not planning, as far as I know, on going to the Middle East and, I don't know, invading Israel, right? They're not preparing for that conflict. The United States, by comparison, kind of has to prepare for the whole entire spectrum of conflict. So I think the pushback is warranted. I'm not saying it's Berger's vision is right or wrong, but I think this process needs to remain flexible as they continue to transform the Marine Corps to this new role. So let me close out with just, as other branches in the military, how the Marine Corps is certainly focused on the future of cyber warfare. I've talked about this in other episodes on how this, the next major conflict the United States is engaged in my opinion, will be initiated by a cyber attack. It's what you do in any ambush against an enemy force. You initiated an ambush with your most devastating weapon. In my opinion, hands down, your most devastating weapon in modern conflict is going to be a cyber attack. And in this instance, with the Marine Corps, Force Design 2030, this is that vision that I was outlining earlier, it acknowledges that this kind of change in the character of war. And what they did was created the Marine Expeditionary Force Information Groups. What they do is they're designed to facilitate friendly maneuver and deny the enemy freedom of action in the information environment. That's their focus. And the Marine Corps has also even recently introduced a new influence officer occupational specialty to synergistically develop cyber warfare and information maneuver operations expertise. These stand-in forces that Berger's vision outlines, they are uniquely positioned for conducting electronic warfare attacks for cyber effects while also thickening joint force intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And for example, the Marine Corps, its force design emphasizes the importance of aerial and ground-based sensors that could be used to provide additional credible sources to expose adversary malign behavior through video or other sensing means, thereby enabling activities such as deterrence by detection, right? Catching someone in the act. Should an adversary conduct aggressive actions against an ally or a partner, Marine Corps sensors, as a part of these lighter, more nimble units inside the WES that the Chinese military power bubble. So should a crisis develop, these same sensor systems could really maintain kind of custody of key targets in support of the entire U.S. military. Kind of reinforces the point of having this capability. Though it's smaller, perhaps even more vulnerable, it is actively engaged in this region that the Chinese so badly want to push out and continue to dominate. So thank you for tuning in. I hope these episodes are interesting for you to understand a little bit more about each of our military branches, how they are pivoting away from the counterterrorism fight, and kind of the future conflicts that America could find itself into. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.